Blog Talk Radio.
Billionaire bankster Penny Pritzker
Oh, yeah, she's a charmer.
That breaks into Obama's cabinet, okay? And another cabinet appointee that he put in was this clown of the FDA, who was a Monsanto lobbyist. Billionaire, this is from Greg Palast, journalist, says, billionaire bankster breaks into Obama's cabinet. You made fun of me when I suggested that President Barack Obama would nominate a confessed bank scammer, a loan-sharking mortgage predator, to his cabinet. But there she blows. Today, Obama, this was on May 2nd, today Obama has named Penny Pritzker Secretary of Commerce. As the president says, it's a milestone. The first female fraudster to hold that post. No longer will criminal bankers have to lobby the administration, because now they'll have one of their own in the cabinet. The following is taken from the chapter Pennies from Heaven. You'll find in my bestseller Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, which is another book of Greg Palast. But it says, we never heard of this guy Barack Obama until 2004. Less than 3 years before taking the presidency, he was in the Illinois State Senate, a swamp of scammers, backhandlers, and backhanders, and the party machine tools. Not a stellar launchpad for the White House. And then one day, State Senator Barack Obama was visited by his fairy godmother. Her name is Penny Pritzker. Pritzker's net worth is listed in Forbes as $1.8 billion, which is one hell of a heavy magic wand in the world of politics. Her wand, excuse me, would have been heavier and her net worth higher, except that in 2001, the federal government fined her and her family $460 million for the predatory, deceitful, racist tactics and practices of Superior, the bank and loan shark operation she ran on the south side of Chicago. Superior was the first of the deregulated go-go banks to go bust at the time, the costliest failure ever. U.S. banksters lost nearly half a billion dollars. U.S. taxpayers lost nearly half a billion dollars. Superior's depositors lost millions, and poor folk in Senator Obama's South Side district lost their homes. Penny did not like paying $460 million. No, not one bit. What she needed was someone to give her hope and change. So she hoped someone would change the banking regulators and the Commerce Department so that she could get away with this crap. Well, Pritzker introduced Obama, the neophyte state senator, to the ladies who lunch, that really is what they call themselves, on Chicago's Gold Coast. Obama got lunch gold and better. And introduction to Robert Rubin. Rubin is a former Secretary of the Treasury, former chairman of Goldman Sachs, and former co-chairman of Citibank. Even atheists recognize Rubin as the supreme deity of Wall Street. And Rubin opened the doors to finance industry vaults for Obama. Extraordinarily, for a Democrat, Obama in 2008 raised three times as much for bankers as his Republican opponent. And so what did Citibank Rubens get for showering Obama with gold? Well, Obama agreed to take care of Rubens' poodles, Larry Summers and Tim Geithner. They became Obama's first cabinet picks, Summers as economic czar and Geithner as his czarina, Secretary of the Treasury. And Geithner and Summers were the agents who under Treasury Secretary Rubin designed the deregulation of banking. In effect, they had decriminalized the kind of financial flim-flammery that brought the planet to its knees while bringing Rubin, Pritzker, and the banksters loads of lucre. And so in 2008, Summers and Geithner were put back in the saddle, and Obama's horse, but Rubin's saddle. Rubin received more than $100 million from Citicorp, the gargantuan commercial bank investment bank casino created by deregulation. It is worth a mention that Rubin's centi-million dollar payoff went unchallenged by Citi's new owner and U.S. Treasury, which had put up more than $1 trillion in loans and guarantees to pull Rubin's creature out of bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Rubin rocked, but Penny was pissed off. And Pritzker had taken this bank senator, community organizer from the ghetto, made him a U.S. senator, then as Obama's campaign finance chairwoman, raised a mind-blowing $750 million to make him president. In return, in 2008, Obama decided to make his patron Penny the Secretary of Commerce. But then in November of 2008, just as Obama was about to submit her nomination to Congress, a bunch of Pritzker's victims marched on Washington. They were not from her busted bank, but unhappy workers from the lucrative nursing homes that her family owns through a string of complex offshore trusts. And Obama slammed the door on Penny's pronto. And then the Pritzker family made its billions mostly from Hyatt hotels and Hyatt nursing homes. Penny, on the Hyatt board of directors, is an infamously combative anti-union apostle. Unite Here, the union that represents Hyatt workers, was called for an international boycott of Hyatt hotels. In 2012, Unite Here and its parent, the AFL-CIO, were crucial to Obama's winning Ohio and Michigan and Wisconsin. So in this last campaign, Obama had to keep his billionaire heiress on the down low. Finally, Obama appeared to keep the door shut on Pritzker throughout the 2012 campaign, reducing her to hosting an election fundraiser at her Gold Coast digs, which she had to bill as a Goldman Sachs PAC event. This marks possibly the first time and last time anyone used Goldman Sachs as a PR cover. But today, with the union's money and votes already pocketed and counting, Obama can give working folks the finger and give Penny her pound of flesh, the Commerce Post. Well, the New York Times says that at Commerce, Ms. Pritzker could provide the president with a new way to reach out to the business community. The last time Pritzker reached out to the business community was to sell them subprime mortgage securities, worthless bags of financial feces, and manufactured by Superior Bank, which was her bank. And by giving Penny, the piggy banker, Commerce, we have to change Obama's rating to subprime. I do note that some women's organizations are applauding the appointment of the first female to the Commerce Post, but I prefer to honor the victims of the Chicago femme fatale. Most of Penny's victims, busted bank borrowers and underpaid healthcare workers, are women, too. But unlike those wounded and destroyed by Pritzker, she worked hard for her money, and it was not easy inheriting her first billion from her daddy. So much for Obama's first, female Commerce appointee. Nothing but a crook and banker.
Yeah, it's pretty sad, isn't it?
Yeah, this is sick. And this is a quickie here, but I really think it's needed. This is another one of Obama's fatal, miserable, horrible people that he put in office. And I just want to do it here. I'll see if I can get it up. I wanted to mention the March Against Monsanto. We mentioned it last night and Occupy the FDA. But Obama is coming through for all of his buddies this year,
his last hurrah.
Yeah, and, the guy that he appointed to the FDA, the head of FDA, is Michael R. Taylor. In 1976, he was a staff attorney for the FDA. In 1981, a lawyer for a firm serving Monsanto. Then in 1991, deputy commissioner for the FDA. And then in 1996 to 2000, he was the vice president for public policy at Monsanto. And then in 2009, he was the senior advisor to the FDA commissioner. 2010 to 2013, presented the deputy commissioner for food to the FDA. So this guy is nothing but a lackey for Monsanto, which is they just gave Monsanto a pass with the recent bill that the Congress passed to make them immune to prosecution for all the millions and billions of dollars they've stolen and all the poisoned food they put out there. So I just thought you should know. And that's what's going on this side of the world. Now I'm going to go to, some good news that came up here. I was glad that Michael Bloomberg got his face full of crap over
this. Yeah, he's the guy I don't care for too much.
New York City's council okays paid sick leave for more than 1 million workers.
New York City workers will receive, starting next year, 5 paid sick days a year to care for themselves or an ill family member under a measure the New York City Council passed 45-3 this afternoon. The vote culminates a four-year effort by a powerful coalition of workers, unions, and community groups. At a press conference before the historic vote, Vincent Alvarez, president of the New York City Central Labor Council, said, "The vote marks a big step in the right direction toward providing paid sick time to workers in our city. I commend the many advocates who have fought so hard to improve the lives of workers and their families through this bill. As this legislation is voted upon, we reaffirm our commitment to protecting and improving the basic rights of all workers here in New York City." The issue had been stalled in the City Council, but late in March, the New York City Campaign for Paid Sick Days, a broad coalition of low-wage workers, women's rights advocates, healthcare providers, small business owners, labor unions, and community organizations, reached an agreement with Council Speaker Christine Quinn to bring the paid sick leave measure to a vote. After the vote, Moms Rising Executive Director Christine Rowe Finkbeiner said, "It's been a long fight, but today the New York City Council heeded the call of New York families and passed a bill that would allow more than a million New Yorkers to earn paid time off to use when they are sick or to take care of a sick child, spouse, or a parent." She challenged Mayor Michael Bloomberg to stand up to corporate lobbyists, listen to the people who elect him, and sign this important bill. Bloomberg has said he will veto the legislation, but the bill passed with a veto-proof margin. The new paid sick leave bill requires firms with 20 or more workers to provide 5 paid sick days beginning in 2014, and 18 months later it would cover companies with 15 or more workers. About 1 million New York City workers currently have no paid sick leave. According to the Center for Economic and Policy Research, more than 40 million people in America work in jobs where they have no access to paid sick days. In addition to the potential loss of wages and jobs for working families, the lack of paid sick days forces many people to go to work when they are contagious and get coworkers and customers sick. No paid sick time also decreases productivity for workers who show up unable to perform at their normal level of ability. Paid time is especially important for low-wage workers who cannot afford the basic necessities when they miss work, because they don't have paid sick leave. In March, Senator Tom Harkin from Iowa and Rosa DeLauro from Connecticut introduced the Healthy Families Act, which would give workers the opportunity to earn paid sick leave they could use for personal illnesses or to take care of sick family members, among other uses.
Yeah, Portland, Oregon, San Francisco, Seattle, Washington, D.C. have implemented paid sick leave requirements. Campaigns or legislative initiatives are underway in Arizona, California.
Well, a whole bunch of other states.
All kinds of states. Yeah, so. That was
horrible that people didn't have any sick leave.
A million workers.
I mean, that was just terrible. Yeah. I'm so glad that was passed for New York City workers.
Yeah,
that
schmuck Bloomberg
was going to veto it.
He's such a schmuck. He really is a schmuck.
I'm sure he has paid sick days.
He's a billionaire. Are you kidding?
Yeah, what does he care?
He doesn't care.
Probably has a private doctor come in and take care of him.
Oh, I'm sure he does.
To go to the hospital.
But, you know, that's just one of the wonderful things that are going on here. But I wanted to go to the next one, which is another kind of interesting article. Hang on a second here. We're reading these issues off the AFL-CIO blog.
And I read one off the Ask Me blog.
Right. Okay.
There was one here that... A vision for retirement security. going to read this.
Oh, wait a minute.
And this, let me read this while you're working. Council 4, AFSCME in Connecticut, has a vision for retirement security. That's why Council 4 is urging legislators to support the concept of an affordable, voluntary public retirement plan to expand retirement security and boost the economy. I think this would be wonderful. Over 686,000 workers in Connecticut between the ages of 25 and 64 do not have access to a retirement plan through their employer in 2010. A new study documents a downward trend in both employer sponsorship of retirement plans and employee participation rates in Connecticut from 1998 to 2012, making it increasingly difficult for workers to prepare for retirement. In 2010, 50% of Connecticut workers, that's 740,000 residents, were not participating in an employer-provided retirement plan. We want to make sure that after a lifetime of work, every future retiree has the opportunity to retire with adequate income and dignity, said Karen Friedman, Executive Vice President and Policy Director of the Pension Rights Center. Friedman testified in favor of SB 54, an act establishing a retirement savings plan for low-income private sector workers. The bill currently awaits action by the state Senate.
Okay.
I think that's a great idea. I really do.
What court says employers' speech rights trump workers' right to know their rights. In other words, what this is saying is that this court says that employees don't have the right to know what their rights are.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
In 2011, the National Labor Relations Board issued a common sense and even-handed rule that said employers must post a notice in the workplace to inform workers of their rights. Simply put, the 11x17 poster would inform workers of their right to join a union and their right not to join a union. Yesterday, a trio of Republican-appointed judges on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit said the
National Labor Relations Board
rule violated the employer's right of free speech. You know, AFL-CIO President Trump would call the court's ruling absurd.
Absurd.
Unbelievable. Yeah, I mean, you get knuckleheads up there on these courts that are such...
In today's workplace,
sold out.
Employers...
Wait. You're not going to get there unless this goes down.
Oh, sorry. In today's workplace, employers are required to display posters explaining wage and hour rights, health and safety, and discrimination laws, even emergency escape routes. The D.C. Circuit Court ruling suggests that courts should strike down hundreds of notice requirements, not only those that inform workers about their rights and warn them of hazards, but also those on cigarette packages, in home mortgages, and many other areas. The court's twisted logic finds that freedom of speech precludes the government from requiring employers to provide certain information to employees. This is absurd. When workers know their rights, the law works as intended. Oh, my God. Where do you get these people? How do they get appointed?
I don't know. After the National Labor Review Board issued the rule.
Relations Board.
The National Association of Manufacturers, the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, an Education Fund, Inc., and the National Federation of Independent Business and several other businesses and right-wing groups filed suit. A judge upheld the rule in March 2012, but the business groups appealed the decision, and a spokesperson for the NLRB said the agency is reviewing the decision. The same rule also is being reviewed by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit in Richmond, Virginia.
Oh, my God.
I mean, this is just absurd craziness, man. You know, that... Yeah, I don't understand. I don't understand how they can get away with this.
Well, I think TechSmart is right. They're going to bring in robots, and they won't care whether they have their rights.
Yeah, cyborg world.
Cyborg.
That's what's happening. We just are losing everything, guys. You know.
Well, and people are going to be too much trouble.
Oh, yeah. We got to make robots. We got to become robots. But you know what? Oh, man, this thing is so weird. Okay, here we go.
Help save the U.S. Postal Service, which is worth reading again because Well, I really think we should say that. I'm very upset about
that. I am too. I mean, the fact that that our Congress is jerking off everybody, all right, you know,
nobody's
the
job is
it's just, you know, they're trying to privatize this thing
and the post
trying to bring it into bankruptcy.
I think they do a fine job.
Yeah, they do. It's just, you know, it's just that.
You get your mail delivered, I mean, or you can have a post office box. It's great for mailing stuff. They're really good about.
Well,
I think at least our post
office. Yeah, I mean, what are they going to do? They want to privatize this thing, and they want to shove everything into it. It's going to cost more, be less efficient, and be a nightmare.
It'll be a mess. Every time they privatize, it's awful.
It says, do you care about keeping post office open, ensuring Saturday delivery for years to come, and stopping proposals to lay off postal workers? Well, they have a petition here, and it says, please sign a petition to support the bill that would end the requirement the U.S. Postal Service's pre-fund 75 years of retiree health care benefits. Okay. And Peter DeFazio of Oregon to file legislation to end this requirement. The legislation that forces the requirement passed by Congress in 2006 is unprecedented and has no other private or public entity has to meet such a standard. That requirement is the key factor driving postal service deficits and debt and defaults and has led to proposals to end Saturday services, close rural post offices, and lay off postal workers. Big Progress reports that USPS would have a U.S. Postal Service would have a $1.5 billion surplus if it wasn't for the pre-funding rule set by the Republican majority in Congress. Senator Bernie Sanders introduced companion legislation in the Senate, and and it says, you can read more from the letter carriers about the truth behind the Postal Service's finance.
And you can go to this blog.
Well, it'd be worth reading that.
Yeah.
Just to show people what kind of insanity it really is.
You have to go to NALC. You get it.
Yeah. It's really sick, though.
I think that's just
wait a minute. I just want to see. It takes a second or two for this page to pull up.
That's a download, but there are postal facts. See what it says there. This is from the Postal Service is facing financial uncertainty. The U.S. Postal Service faces a serious budget crisis and must seek to increase its revenue and carefully reduce overhead expenses. The explosion of electronic communication has permanently changed how the world connects, and the Postal Service must adapt to that change. But the crisis is not simply a result of increased Internet usage and a tough economy, as you might think. Despite the worst recession in 80 years, the Postal Service has done well operationally. In the fiscal years 2007 through 2010, it had a net operational profit of $611 million delivering the mail. Most of the financial red ink is the result of a particularly burdensome congressional mandate. And that's what Leo was talking about. And that's the fact that they have to...
fund 75 years.
Right.
I mean, 75 years in the future of these pensions, okay, which is like insanity. No other company, nothing else in the world has to do that. And
the
cost of prohibitive.
In just 10 years, they have to set aside enough money to pay almost all retiree health benefits for the next 75 years.
Sure.
And that was designed to bankrupt the post office.
Sure.
That was done
sure.
by the Republicans.
And we, you can go to that, by the way, if you want to go to Postal Facts.
What did we go to? Delivering for America is what it's
website.
Called.
Delivering for America, yeah. Postal Facts. So you can go to that. I'm going to call Larry now. You know, Larry Dorman is coming on to speak to us.
And he's a public affairs coordinator for AFSCME Council 4 out of New Britain, Connecticut. So he'll be on with us in just a minute. But that's, you know, interesting about the post office. Not only do they do a great job, they've made money. And that doesn't seem to help them much because they have to fund. And we're calling Larry right now. Hopefully he's home.
Hello.
Hi, Larry. It's Lila. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Hello, I'm just fine. And Leo.
Hey, Leo. How you doing?
Good. Good.
So you've been really busy, huh? Did you have a busy week in the last couple of weeks with a celebration of workers' rights? And I'm sure you're out speaking different places.
Yeah, we've been. We have things going on everywhere. It's really incredible. A lot of fights going on. A lot of struggles in the cities and towns.
Yeah.
We're gonna be at the Bridgeport Housing Authority on Friday with Congressman Jim Himes to talk about sequestration and how that's affected public housing. So really, just there's an extraordinary amount of things happening.
One thing that I was looking at on Council Foresight, which I really am interested in, was the article on a vision for retirement security. And the fact that I think that's a wonderful, wonderful bill that's been put forward.
Thank you. It is an effort that we're undertaking, and would urge people to go to council4.org and see what Lila's talking about, which is Senate Bill 54. And it's basically to set up a state-administered pension plan that workers and businesses could purchase, and it would be an instrument that's much more stable and secure than a 401k. And it's our effort to try to address the retirement crisis. People are getting ready to retire, and study after study, and there was a special on PBS Frontline late last month showing that the people do not have the ability to retire with any degree of security or certainty. They barely have Social Security, let alone a defined benefit pension plan or enough savings. And people
have been cashing
out 401ks just to survive and pay bills. So this is our effort to try to provide some kind of measure of retirement security for people as they get ready to do that.
Do you think there's a lot of support for that in our legislature?
I think there's a lot of legislative support. I think we're going to have some challenges in getting the leadership to move on it and not let it languish on the calendar. There's about a month left in the legislative session. And I know this is a good bill because some pretty powerful interests are lobbying against it, the financial services industry.
Oh, really?
Companies like Mass Mutual and other financial service companies have testified against it. They're trying to kill it because it's competition, and we know that these big companies don't actually like competition. They want to be able to shake people down.
What was your opinion, or did you know about Obama's recent appointment to the Commerce the Commerce Secretary? Penny Pritzker.
Yeah.
Have you heard about that?
Billionaire. I sure did.
Yeah,
sure did.
He's a billionaire bankster and a Superior Bank of Chicago that almost completely funded his presidency.
I mean, typically Republicans appoint when it comes to the Commerce secretaries, they're always going to pick someone from the business sector, and unfortunately it's not always going to be this is something that both parties are guilty of. They appoint people to Commerce who generally practice that running roughshod model.
Yeah. I was very disappointed when she appointed her, and she's
totally anti-union.
I answer your question, I was disappointed.
Yeah.
I have such low expectations when it comes to presidential appointments for Commerce Secretary. The Commerce Secretary is going to be a champion of business at all costs. And, certainly that's what they got in Pritzker.
You got that right. I mean, he couldn't have picked, if that was his model for appointing a person.
Well, he owed her big time,
and I had a really deep and long and good conversation with a couple of friends of mine on Monday. We were talking about this. They're very lifelong Democratic voters, very progressive minded guys. These are state employees, a couple of state employees I know, management types, actually. They're not in the union. And, you know, one of them was really expressing some deep disappointment in Obama's inability to or unwillingness to use the bully pulpit with regard to the Wall Street guys and the banks and everything else that's been going on. And, you know, that's just he's done some really good things, and then unfortunately he's failed to use that bully pulpit to call out the business people and the banks, and this is an example of that.
He owes his election to the bankers. I mean, they gave him a lot of money, and he went
easy on them after the crash.
On. You know, I wish he showed a little more loyalty to us.
I can understand why you'd say that. I think that it's a little bit depressing to see that the lessons have not been learned. And that the banks and the financiers are practicing new dangerous models, risky investment models, and people are saying we're going to go through another torturous cycle one of these days. So, if anybody reads Rolling Stone, it's the only magazine actually that or one of the few that's credibly covering the financial crisis. That guy Matt Taibbi is, you should get him on your show. I mean, he's amazing, and he just keeps writing issue after issue about how both parties have colluded to allow the banks to skate away unscathed, you know?
Well, that's for sure. They certainly have. I mean, it doesn't really seem to matter what ordinary people say or do, and the unions have advocated for ordinary people, and the banks just turn a deaf ear and keep giving themselves bonuses, bankrupting people and countries. You know, it just seems incredible that they get away with it.
They do.
You'd think they'd feel a little shame as human beings, but they don't seem to.
No, I really do think, that chasing the buck it's squeezing every last dollar. And again, you look at what's happened in the factory in Bangladesh. You look at the West Texas fertilizer plant explosion. I mean, really, you have this overclass that doesn't care if people die, if it's going to put some money in their pockets. And that's really a sad commentary.
Well, I think, between you and I...
And everybody who's listening.
And everyone, yeah.
Yeah.
This thing with Bangladesh... This has been going on and on and on and on, and still does. For some reason, the world still doesn't catch it. You know what I mean? They still have a $5 T-shirt, made by some poor Bangladeshi making a penny, for the shirt. There were 780 people died in that crash.
The number keeps rising. My God.
Oh, isn't it awful?
I mean, my God. I mean, can't...
And people say, why do you need unions? There was there was an editorial in the Times, thankfully, last week in the New York Times. A guy wrote about the fact that, what those workers need is a union, because this is why we have unions, to protect workers, to stop the kind of exploitation that's going on. I'll tell you a quick story. Part of my awakening a few years ago, about 8-9 years ago, there was a lecture at Central Connecticut. A guy named Charles Kernighan, he formed the Labor Rights Committee out of New York City. He was the guy who called out Kathy Lee Gifford on her use of slave labor for her wardrobe.
Remember
that? Yeah. So he raised money to have, and he was accompanying these Bangladeshi workers. So they spoke at Central Connecticut, and there was a translator, and one of the young women was talking about how on the assembly line, one of her coworkers was pregnant and was beaten, in a pregnant state. And the workers didn't know this, but what she told us was that they were sewing buttons and loops into jeans for Walmart. So it's this shadowy network of subcontracting manufacturers who work for companies like Walmart. And people are getting, pregnant women are being beaten on the assembly line. They're working in overheated conditions to sew buttons and loops, belt loops, et cetera, zippers, on jeans that Walmart used to call Old Glory. You know, I mean, just talk, you know, these companies, they just pervert the whole ideals, every ideal that our country stands for. It's just disgusting.
Well, here is probably one of the most unbelievable farces I've ever seen of justice. We just read this article about these judges that just overturned the right to hang on a second. I've got the article here. Where the court says employers' speech rights trump workers' rights.
To know their rights.
And this is this group, this judge, this panel of judges.
In Washington, D.C.
Columbia. Said employers must post it was against the National Labor Relations Board, issued a common sense and even-handed rule that said employers must post a notice in the workplace to inform workers of their rights. And simply put, it was I've seen them, everybody's seen them, they're 11 by 17 poster that informs workers of their rights to join a union and their right or not to join a union. And
right.
Yesterday, I guess, the three Republican-appointed judges, U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, said the National Labor Review Board rule violated the employer's right of free speech. Right?
Yeah. I'm laughing because how else do you respond? It's sick.
Richard Trumka called the court's ruling absurd. And he was absolutely right.
Think of all the things that are posted in the workplace. You know, they tell you how to get out because of a fire. They show you where the fire exit is. They show you if there's hazardous material.
OSHA laws.
All kinds of things. They now say that you have to take all those down too.
Yeah.
Right. And really, one of the bitter ironies of that decision. Is the fact that it's not the employer's right to free speech, it's the employer's right to censorship.
Squelching
and squashing people's rights, their right to know what their own basic fundamental constitutionally guaranteed rights such as free association are. So really it's a ticket to encourage censorship and to encourage repression of workers' rights. And I'm with you. I mean, I read that and I'm putting it in my news clippings tomorrow. I mean, I'm stunned because, you know, it's not a long step from those rulings to the explosion in West Texas and the fire in Bangladesh. It really isn't. You know, this is how it starts. You handcuff people, you take away their rights to speak and to act, and, you know, before you know it, you got Bangladesh. We may be having a very different conversation in a few years, you know, really.
What can be done about something like that? Will the National Labor Relations Board go back in and appeal that decision, do you think?
It'll go to the Supreme Court.
Or will it go to the, you know, what will happen?
Right. I mean, it'll get appealed, but, you know, the Supreme Court isn't exactly, you know, apart from the ruling on Obamacare, the Supreme Court has sided squarely with corporations every step of the way, including the famous or infamous, I should say, Citizens United decision.
Yeah.
So, right now, this Supreme Court, unless a couple of these guys go away and die off, the next president's going to inherit that Supreme Court, meaning that 5-4 majority with the.
Can Congress actually impeach one of these guys? Can they actually get rid of
That's
these?
That's a really good question. I think they're appointed for. I think they're just appointed for life.
I think so too, and I always wondered if they could actually rid Congress of that. I mean, under corruption or collusion or some sort. But I mean,
the nitwits in Congress who stand for the same perverse things that the Supreme Court guys like Lee and Roberts do.
Reenacted the. Insider trading law
they decided that they'd repeal last year because
it was election year and everybody was on them about it, and they found out that they were allowed to have insider trading. Congressmen, senators could invest in bills, in companies or in projects and stuff that they were passing bills on. all right? Mm-hmm. So all of these clowns like McConnell and everybody else, you wondered how they made $23 to $25 million through their careers by, you know, investing on bills that they were pushing through.
And
what they did is 1 year later, just last week, they overturned that ruling, and now they're able to do it again. They're back in business. Imagine
it's called
that.
Greed. It's called greed, and it's what rules the day.
Nobody complained about it.
And of course, they were okay with all of sequester.
Oh yeah.
They were fine with that, except when they needed to get flights out of the local D.C. airports, they put money back in for the controllers.
Right,
because it affected them directly.
Yeah. I mean, and are proud of it.
Right.
And they didn't put any more money in. What they did is they transferred monies from other areas, all right?
So they could get their
flights. Right. So whatever it was, they cut something else out of the FAA budget, all right? And so that they could put back a few air traffic controllers. The hypocrisy of this and criminality of this Congress is right up there with, I don't even know.
Have to have the worst Congress in the history of the country. I can't think of a worse one.
Yeah,
I know, you keep thinking it won't get worse, but it does. I mean, you know, that's why, I'm glad you brought up the sequesters. I said we're going to be doing a press conference Friday in Bridgeport at the Housing Authority. Public housing is important to this country. You know, it's important to a lot of middle and low income people, and especially seniors. And we have a situation in Bridgeport where the sequester is directly responsible for the possible layoff of 14 of our members, people who maintain the facilities, people who work with the tenants and deal with their questions.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have a press conference to show that, you know, this sequester thing was never about, repairing the debt or getting us on a good financial course. It was about hurting regular people to protect the billionaires and to protect the big corporations.
It seems like everybody tries so hard to bring attention to what's happening, but it's very hard to get any traction forward.
It is. You hit it on the head. I mean, we need like a million more of you guys, you know, because the mainstream media isn't telling the story.
Oh, they say nothing. The sequester doesn't exist.
And you never hear anything about unions other than, you know, the little bit that they gave you when you had a million workers and a union people and going after the governor of Ohio there. And
right.
That was the last time you heard anything
about unions.
It is, but to the extent that I can give bad guys, evil guys, the credit. I mean, the Koch brothers, those nasty billionaires who are funding all the anti-worker stuff around the country. I mean, you know, the Republicans, the corporations, the powerful and elite, you know, they've been planning this stuff for 30 plus years.
They're ahead of us in a lot of things.
Yeah, you know, they've been planning how to degrade government and get people to hate government, hate taxes, hate public employees, and it's paying off, and it's unfortunately the political left and others are just kind of, you know, they've been sort of on the sideline watching this stuff, scratching their head, going, how could all this be happening? And, you know, it hasn't been an accident, you know, and now the Koch brothers are talking about buying media properties, which is just frightening.
In the LA Times.
They want to buy the Tribune Company, the Times Tribune Company, which is Chicago, LA, Hartford Current, Baltimore. So, you know, how scary is that, you know?
Oh, it's very scary. I mean, radio has been all bought up.
There's hardly
a voice on the radio.
Yep.
It's all right-wing garbage on the radio.
It's right-wing and bullcrap left-wing stuff, which is NPR. I mean, my God, the amount of real news that comes out of that one is frightening,
PBS does do some good stuff, though, because they, you know, you got Frontline, you got really good shows. I mean, nobody did a better job in the financial meltdown I think, on TV than, you know, PBS Frontline, and they've got America reframed and Independent Lens. It's just, you know, not enough people are seeing that stuff.
Our NPR is
NPR, I think they're scared. You know, I think they've been bullied into getting away from what they know is good.
Well,
solid
they also
coverage.
Receive a lot of donations from the right now.
Oh, my God. And,
right.
You know, the Koch
so they feel runners, obligated.
The Koch, yeah. I mean, we were watching the CPTV the other night, and, I mean, one of the major funders for Masterpiece Theater and for all these other, or science, oh, some science show and stuff, was all the Koch brothers, all right?
I was about to say, the Koch brothers contribute a lot to public TV.
And,
so that's scary.
It is.
So very scary.
They take control of all of that.
And Greg Palast, the reporter, a great reporter there, he used to say, he called them National Petroleum Radio. All right.
Yeah.
NPR, National Petroleum Radio, because I mean they're all funded by Exxon or Mobil or you know whatever.
And
it's like there's no free speech there.
No.
You know, it's all up. And you know, and it's the same with NPR and CPTV. And you know, it's all.
The thing is, I personally would like to see workers support each other in a more determined way. You know, like. If someone say some workers in New Haven at Yale go out on strike, that workers in other parts of the state should support them very actively.
Right,
you know,
and
I think that's part
of what we've got to do a better job of. Yeah.
I think we really do have to do a better job of that, because the only way we can move forward is to make a bigger impression, and with a bigger impression takes numbers. And
well,
that's when you get paid attention to.
Well, that's true. And but one of the major problems with some of these, with a lot of the unions, is not just that. You got a lot of people within the unions that don't even support their unions. You know what I mean?
Right.
That can be a problem too.
True. You know, and again, that's because they've been, you know, we've allowed the wealthy and the right to drive wedges, you know, even among AFL-CIO union membership, so that you have a lot of union members kind of buying that garbage that gets spewed out, you know, on Fox and elsewhere. You know what? And I guess that's what I'm saying is that there's been this sort of 30-year plan, 40-year plan, even, you know, and what it's doing is it's pitting middle class against the middle class in this spiraling race to the bottom. You know, and that's been the, you know, so you've got workers, you know, attacking workers. So you've got, you know, somebody up in Salisbury or wherever saying, you know, why the heck does that public works guy have a pension and I don't?
Yeah.
You know, why does he have health care? Why does that paraprofessional, that teacher's aide get health care and I don't? You know, screw the paraprofessional. I mean, that's the mentality that's prevailing, and that's not an accident. You know, it's purposeful. It's politically engineered, you know, hatred and warfare within, you know, the middle class, I think.
Yeah, instead of fighting for everybody to have a pension, they want to take away the pensions of the few people that have it.
Yeah.
And that's why I say all this stuff, you know, from wealth inequality to the anti-union garbage you see going on, it is all politically engineered. I think that's just my point, you know, is that, you know, it didn't happen accidentally. It's purposeful policy funded by really rich, bad people who want more for themselves and less for everyone else.
I think you're absolutely right. But, you know, that means that labor has to have a plan. And, you know, it's like in any battle, he who strikes the first blow always has the advantage, whether they're right or wrong.
Right. You're right. You're right. And, you know, Leo and Lyle, you're both bringing up a really good point, which is how do we get, you know, how do we get that anger and that sense of, not just the anger, though, but the sense of commonality back? Because, you know, in European countries, the workers will hit the streets in a heartbeat if you talk about cutting their pensions.
That's right.
But here, it's just you're rolling a rock up a really big hill to get that kind of worker
solidarity. I look at that, you know, and watch television, and because I like to see what the mainstream media is doing. And often, if there's austerity measures, the Greeks hit the street, the English get furious, but we don't have that kind of passion here.
To me, one of the biggest jokes is the United Kingdom. I mean, you know, they're the most oppressed, probably the
most oppressed country.
Surveilled.
You know?
Oh, my God.
You know,
there's a camera on every corner.
Our Orwellian vision is that. And they've got the audacity, you know, to support this 89-year-old, queen, all right?
Right.
5-year-old Prince Philip, okay? And, you know, who are actually considered the wealthiest. She's the wealthiest person in the entire world with estimated value, personal value, okay, of over, I believe the last said it was $15 trillion, all right?
That's incredible.
$15 trillion, okay, that is her own personal wealth, okay, because everything is in her name. Everything belongs to the queen.
Yep.
Yeah, and between her private estates and everything else. And
she owns a lot of land in this country.
And yeah, they, you know, but you don't really see. I mean, it was that big riot they had last year, or a year or two ago, where they took to the streets and were, you know, banging everything. And then all of a sudden, there was a huge military crackdown on everybody, police crackdown. And then you don't hear anything from the UK other than the.
No, it's been quiet. You're right. You're absolutely right. And
I mean, they're a joke. But you got. I was just reading today that huge riots out in France right now over their austerity cuts, and you know, and of course Greece is a sad situation. But I went before.
But it all shows what happens. This austerity thing is a bunch of crap, you know.
It doesn't work.
Well, what do you
doesn't
you,
work?
Hey, what do you think of the what happened in Cyprus? Can you see that happening here? You know,
sure.
With them taking.
How could you not?
Right, with freezing all the monies, all right?
Yeah.
Charging taxes on deposits and stuff.
Charging
like
you for your own money.
Yeah. That was unbelievable. But can you see that happening here?
Well,
how could, that's the first thing I thought of. You know, you know. Again, we're, you know, we got through the crash of 08, which was, again, you know, that was engineered by an elite group of greedy manipulators. I mean, you know, that stuff's going to start happening if we don't get things fixed.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I know you guys in the union work really, really hard to keep things more balanced, but God, it's such an uphill battle, and you have to, as you said, they've been working for 30 years, and we're reacting to these plans that have been put in place and in motion by these very, very powerful people. It's a real uphill battle, but I'm so glad you guys don't give up. I don't know
I appreciate what you guys do, and you know, like I said, we need to multiply you by you know, thousands. And but you're doing, you're fighting, you know, you're fighting and you're speaking out, and that's what people need to do in a democracy. We're not going to get anywhere if we don't do that.
I agree 100%, and I sure hope that pension plan goes through for Connecticut workers.
We'll be able to tell you about it next month. We'll see what happens.
I hope so, and I hope it's a success. And we want to thank you very much again for being on the show.
Sorry.
Thanks,
Leo.
Thanks, Lila.
You have to say, and keep on fighting.
Good. I'll be in touch. Thank you.
All right. Good night, Larry.
Take care. Good night.
And that was Larry Dorman, the ASME Union.
Council 4 out of New Britain, Connecticut. He's a public affairs coordinator. He goes around speaking around the state. And he has a newsletter that he sends out. And
we got about 30 seconds here. So
is that all we have?
Yeah.
Oh,
so,
boy.
I'm going to say good night, and, you know, stay, tell your friends about the show, and get in the union, folks, and support your unions.
Try to stay informed. I know it's hard.
Yeah.
All right. Good night, folks.
Good night, everybody. Join me tomorrow night when I have a special edition of the L.A. Steel Show.